It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, what does the mainstreaming of gay culture mean for America's gay neighborhoods?
First, we're taking a look at the latest news regarding the controversial voter ID law in Wisconsin. Three Wisconsin agencies tasked with implementing the new law said this weekend that they don't have any extra money to help voters and poll workers comply with voter ID. Additionally, those agencies say they don't have funding for public information or awareness campaigns about changes at the polls.
Our next guest says the lack of economic resources to implement the law looks like a deliberate effort to make it harder for voters to follow it. Jay Heck is with us. He's executive director for Common Cause in Wisconsin. Jay, welcome back to the show.
Happy last day of summer, Rob and Veronica. Great to be with you.
Well, so we heard the news. The Government Accountability Board, Division of Motor Vehicles, and Department of Health Services don't have extra money budgeted to put voter ID in place. What was your reaction when you saw that?
Well, you know, look, first of all, you have to understand that this is, no other state has tried to implement photo voter ID this close to an election. This was 52 days out when the decision was rendered by the three-judge panel in Chicago, three Republican appointments. And 52 days is not very long to inform the public of massive changes in how they're going to be able to vote. But what was most shocking was there didn't seem to be any urgency on the part of the Republican-controlled legislature to meet in the Joint Finance Committee to appropriate additional funds for a public information campaign. The Government Accountability Board and the Department of Motor Vehicles, in which the burden is going to fall on, as you mentioned, no additional funds to add personnel or to do any public outreach in order to inform voters of what's happening. And the reason that I say that it's somewhat deliberate is that, first of all, when the judges issued the order on September 12th, they said that the state of Wisconsin may institute this. They don't have to. But, of course, the governor and the legislature were very eager to have this implemented. And then when you don't supply the necessary resources to inform all the citizens of Wisconsin of the changes that are occurring, and then if you look at what effect this will have, and nobody argues that this will have a disproportionate effect on people that vote on the Democratic side. The constituencies or the segments of the population that this will most affect are college students, people in big cities, Milwaukee, minority voters, elderly people. And so if you don't get the information out to everybody, and particularly to those groups, then they're going to be confused at election time. They may show up at the polls without the requisite required ID. And, there's great confusion. So that's why I say it's deliberate. If there's no resources being put aside to inform the public in a mass way, I think the Republicans feel that they will benefit by the confusion and the lack of knowledge out there in the, for the public.
But the Government Accountability Board has said, yeah, it's going to be tough, but we can get this into place. The message to the public is pretty simple. Get some kind of government-issued ID to go to the polls. Does it really require that much in the way of a public information campaign to get that simple message across?
Well, I think it does because, first of all, the Government Accountability Board, you wouldn't expect them to say anything other than that. You know, they're under heavy fire all the time from the governor and the legislature because they're an independent agency and they're not run by partisans. But, you know, so you would expect that they would say, yes, we'll do the best we can. But they freely admit they don't have any resources for public outreach. And the problem with not having that is by simply issuing a press release that public radio carries and some newspapers carry, but the general public generally is not tuned into this story. There's just a lot of people who are not going to know about what they need to do. So it's fallen to organizations like mine and the League of Women Voters and others to try to do the best that we can to inform people of the ID that they're going to need to have. But as I say, this has never been done this close before an election, and it's just astonishing that there hasn't been a priority given To mail, for instance, every person in Wisconsin of voting age, eligible voting age, something in the mail telling them specifically what the changes are. Just issuing a couple of press releases, it's simply not going to reach everybody that it needs to reach.
Well, is this maybe just a case that got caught off, we as a state got caught off guard? We had a state Supreme Court ruling with those new DMV requirements on free ID for some. We had this circuit court ruling, as you said, not long before the election. Is it deliberate, or did we just get caught a little off guard?
Well, the courts operate on a calendar that's not concurrent with the election calendar. But it doesn't take a genius to see. Well, first of all, nobody expected that the Court of Appeals in Chicago was going to rule. Some expected they might rule this way, but nobody expected that they would have implementation of voter photo ID for the November 4th election. So that caught everybody off guard, even the proponents. So nobody was really prepared for this. Now, proponents, people that support photo voter ID, say, well, we had it in 2011. So everybody knows about it. Well, that was only in effect for one very low turnout February election in 2012, which something like 10% of the population came out to vote. And there weren't massive amounts of people who wanted to vote and then were turned away at the polls because they didn't have the proper ID. So, you know, I think in all fairness, this should not have been implemented until after the November 4th election, because there just isn't adequate time or resources, by the way, to inform people of the changes that have occurred. It's confusing, and I think it's a recipe ripe for great dissatisfaction on election day when people show up and find out that they can't cast their vote, or they can cast their vote, but they're going to have to get a specific form of ID and then trek down to their county office by the Friday after the election to show this ID, which many of them just don't have.
When this law was first passed back in 2011, I think the DMV opened for some extended hours in many offices, offered ID cards for free. So given that we had that shot across the bow back in 2011, isn't that incentive enough for us to take the opportunity to get the IDs we need? Are there really going to be that many people still without voting IDs?
Well, I think there are because, you know, and particularly for college students, for instance, had this not been implemented for the November 4th election, you know, say you live, you're a resident of Minnesota or Illinois or Michigan, but you're going to school in Wisconsin and you want to vote in Wisconsin. Well, you could have just taken your Minnesota driver's license to your polling place and registered to vote on election day. Provided you lived in the state for 28 days, and you would have been able to vote. Now, you know, lots of students aren't going to be able to do that. They're going to have to take time out of their schedule. And let's be honest, students, this is not a priority for students to trek on down to the DMV. Most of them don't have cars anyway. So it's going to disenfranchise a lot of college students. It's also going to disenfranchise a lot of people that just don't have the ability to get to the DMVs very easily to get them. Keep in mind that most of the DMVs, well, all of them in Wisconsin, are not open on the weekends, and there's many in rural counties that are only open one or two days between now and the election. So it's going to be extremely difficult for people. And again, that's bad enough, but not coming together, the legislative leaders who wanted to push this through and making the resources available to inform the public, tells me, and I think tells a lot of people, that they welcome the confusion, they welcome the lack of information for the public, and they think that that will ultimately benefit their side in the upcoming election and keep people who might be voting for the other political party from not being able to vote. So that's why I'm very suspicious about how this is being done so far.
Given how the circuit court ruled and when it ruled, what would you like to have seen as a timeline for implementing voter ID? Obviously, you'd prefer not to have it effective for November's election.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, It's the Court of Appeals in Chicago, not the Circuit Court. But it's but what I mean at the very least, if they were going to rule in favor of this, then they should have set a reasonable time limit when it could be implemented. And you know, when you make a decision that 52 days before a general election, it's very difficult to get the information out to enough people so that everyone will be prepared and have at least the opportunity to get the necessary ID. So at the very least, it should have been postponed. Implementation should have been postponed until the next election in 2015, which I think there's probably a February or April election, and at least give county clerks and everybody else and then give the public an opportunity to get these IDs. You know, in many cases, people, even though they're going to be able to get them for free, they will still lack the birth certificate they need to get the free ID. And, you know, even though they can go to the DMV and say, I don't have a birth certificate, that's going to take a week or more for the DMVs to do the search to get the birth certificate. So, you know, like a lot of people, they're going to wait until the last couple of weeks before the election to tune in, and it'll be too late for many of them. So,
Jay, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Jay Heck, Executive Director for Common Cause in Wisconsin. He was with us to discuss the news that there isn't extra money budgeted to help implement the controversial voter ID law here in Wisconsin.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A couple years back, statistics master Nate Silver described himself as sexually gay but ethnically straight. That kind of statement has given rise to the idea that we're moving toward a post-gay America. Our guest says that doesn't mean there's no discrimination, only that people are defining themselves in ways that aren't focused on their sexual orientation.
So the question on the table is, as we move into a post-gay era, what does the move mean for America's longtime gay neighborhoods like Boys Town in Chicago or the Castro in San Francisco? Is the LGBT community moving out and everybody else moving in? Amin Gaziani joins us now. He's Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of British Columbia and the author of the new book, There Goes the Gayborhood. Amin, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So when we use the term gay neighborhood, what are we talking about?
Gay neighborhoods have four defining qualities. First, they have a distinct geographic focal point. In other words, locals and tourists can point these areas out on a map, usually by identifying one or two specific streets. They have a unique culture. LGBT individuals set the tone, character, or complexion of the area, which is why we see rainbow flags as we walk along the streets. They have a concentration of residences. While everyone who lives in these districts does not self-identify as gay or lesbian, of course, a statistically sizable proportion of the population certainly does. And finally, they have a cluster of commercial spaces and nonprofit community organizations.
Are there things that define a gay neighborhood culturally besides who lives there? You named some of them, but are there things that are more universal?
Absolutely. Certainly, in addition to the visible symbols, such as the rainbow flags, we know that it is in these spaces that sexual minorities create a unique way of life and expressions of culture and communities, such as the annual Pride Parade. They articulate a distinct political voice and vision in these areas. We know, for instance, the Castro District was crucial for the election of Harvey Milk to public office. They gestate organizations and businesses that range from bars to bookstores and community centers and nonprofit organizations. And finally, they find each other for friendship and fellowship.
Well, you yourself lived for a long time in Boys Town, a gay neighborhood in Chicago. And to use that example, what kinds of changes did you see there as being gay became mainstream?
I lived in the Boys Town district for the 9 years that I was a graduate student at Northwestern University. And during those years, my friends and I would have regular conversations about changes that we were informally witnessing along the streets. For instance, the presence of more heterosexual couples and families, changes in the storefronts. For instance, a sex store might close, a nail salon would open in its place. And finally, we would also remark on the increasing presence of straight people in gay bars.
Now, in Chicago, you've seen a move of the LGBT community in Boys Town, for instance, to the north, to Andersonville, for example. What is driving changes like that? We're using this, by the way, as an example of what's happening in other gay neighborhoods. But what do you think is driving changes?
Sure. Well, first of all, I should mention that historically, the LGBT community in Chicago has moved steadily northward for quite a long time. The community initially was concentrated in what was once known as Tower Town, or the downtown Gold Coast area as we think about it today. And then it migrated northward to Old Town, New Town, which currently is the intersection of Diversey and Broadway, and Clark, to Boys Town, the Lakeview neighborhood. Now there's a northward migration to Andersonville and even Rogers Park. In terms of what's prompting this, I think that some gays are being priced out while others are evolving out, if you will. It is certainly the case that areas that have large concentrations of same-sex households experience greater increases in housing costs compared to the national average. But I also think that there are cultural factors at play here, specifically the fact that we live in a time characterized by unprecedented societal acceptance of same-sex relationships.
Now, you write that gay people are pretty much everywhere in the United States these days. And is it fair to say that there may be these gay neighborhoods like Boys Town, like the Castro, but basically LGBTQ people live all over? They live in rural areas and urban areas, conservative and liberal states and neighborhoods, that there's not really the concentration that you might have seen once upon a time.
There is still a concentration, but it's not necessarily as pronounced. So we know that traditional areas of the city that we think about as gay neighborhoods, places like the Castro in San Francisco or Boys Town in Chicago, are in fact deconcentrating, to borrow a word that demographers use. When we compare the 2000 and 2010 U.S. censuses, we see that on average, both male and female same-sex households are now less separated from heterosexual households. In fact, gay and lesbian households reside in 93% of all counties in the U.S.
Now, are straight people moving in and driving out the old-time residents of gay neighborhoods, or is it just that as being gay becomes more mainstream, you know, those residents feel more comfortable being anywhere and feeling that they have the support that they need?
It's both, in fact. So there is a de-gaying and a straightening, if you will. So non-heterosexuals are moving out and straight people are moving in. In light of increased acceptance of homosexuality, many LGBT people now feel safer living in more areas of the city than they had considered in the past. So where gay neighborhoods once provided a beacon of tolerance in a sea of heterosexual hostilities, we live in a moment now where people feel increasingly safe living in many more areas than they had considered before. Similarly, as the stigma against homosexuality wanes, more straight people feel that gay neighborhoods present a viable option for them and their families as well.
Lesbians, you found, are often the front runners in establishing new gay neighborhoods. How come?
Lesbians actually seek out areas of the city that are affordable for them, in part because we know that the gender wage gap persists, and also because they're looking to live in areas with others who are like them. They will select areas of the city that are progressive, where they can plug into the institutions that already exist, for instance, theaters, coffee shops, bike shops, cooperative grocery stores. In fact, there's a sociologist in New York who refers to lesbians as, quote, canaries in the urban coal mine, unquote.
Well, your book has a question mark in the title. There goes the gayborhood. There's a question mark there. So I guess that's the question on the table right now. So do you see gayborhoods as becoming a thing of the past, or maybe moved into something that's more of a tourist category?
I don't think that the answer is simple or straightforward, if you will. These areas are certainly changing, and there's a lot of demographic evidence that shows that they are changing, along with cultural factors that suggest that both LGBT individuals and heterosexuals are reimagining their relationship with sexuality and the city. On the other hand, we live in a moment that have more places with a distinct association with same-sex sexuality than we have ever seen before. In fact, the diversity of LGBT communities is today matched by a diversity of urban and non-urban options. New Yorkers, for instance, talk about Chelsea on the one hand and a chocolate Chelsea on the other. a place that signifies special appeal for African Americans. Similarly, they trade stories about Hell's Kitchen on the one hand and Hell's Cocina on the other for the Latino LGBTQ population. And as we've just discussed, there are distinct places for lesbians and even aging gays and lesbians. So there's an incredible diversity of options that exist today.
Amin, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Amin Ghaziani, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of British Columbia, and he's the author of the new book. It's called There Goes the Gayborhood.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll speak with one of the coordinators of the Wisconsin Environmental Group that brought people from around the state to New York City this weekend for the world's largest ever climate march.
First, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech is looked back on as a masterpiece, stirring the nation's conscience in no small measure because of King's skill at deploying analogies. Let's take a listen.
But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice.
A bank of justice with great vaults of opportunity, where would we be without analogies? Like fish out of water, as annoying as nails on a chalkboard?
Just how powerful are analogies, and how can they sway or persuade us? And they can, as our next guest suggests, play a major role in innovation.
With us now is John Pollock. He's a former presidential speechwriter for Bill Clinton, and he's the author of the new book, Shortcut, How Analogies Reveal Connections, Spark Innovation, and Sell Our Greatest Ideas. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, before we dig into the power of an analogy, lay out the basics. What is an analogy? And do it without using any analogies, please.
I'll try. An analogy is a comparison that suggests parallels between two different things, either explicitly or implicitly.
Now, you start your book with a great story about how you used an analogy to good effect to sort of land yourself a job at the White House. Can you tell us that story as an example?
Sure. I had been working as a speechwriter on Capitol Hill for a number of years, had left the Hill and got a call one day from the White House. There was an opening on the president's team, and would I be interested? Now, I had tried to get into the White House a number of times and had been unsuccessful. And, of course, I said, yes, I would be very interested. And I went in the next day for an interview. And I sat on a couch in the West Wing in the office of the chief speechwriter, and it was one of those couches that had seen better days. And if I leaned back too far, I'd sink into the cushions and disappear. If I leaned forward, I might fall off, and I was really on edge. And the chief speechwriter looked at my resume and said, "You know, I can see, you know, you've got the qualifications. I've looked at your writing, but what is this cork boat?" And I had added this line to my resume the night before because I wanted to show that I was doing something, not just sitting around. And indeed, I was. I had been working to build this boat out of wine corks. I had been saving corks for 30 years, and the goal was to take it on an epic journey. And I explained this quest to him, and I could see that I was losing the conversation there and that he probably thought I was some whack job and they couldn't afford to hire a speechwriter who wasn't, you know, of sound mind. And suddenly, as my future slipped away, this analogy popped into my mind, and I don't know where it came from, but here it is. And I said, listen, building a cork boat and writing a good speech are a lot alike, because if you take a jumble of one or a jumble of the other, corks or words, disorganized, they mean nothing. But if you put them into just the right order, they'll take you on the most amazing journey.
And that got you the gig.
Well, it got me out of the hole right there. And he got the analogy. I ended up getting the job. And it was fortunate that came to mind. It's interesting, though, in the second interview with the other speechwriters, just to check the chemistry between us, they said, well, listen, it's toward the end of the Clinton administration. How do you feel about coming in toward the end? And I said, look, dawn and sunset are the most interesting times of day. So a good analogy is a great way to get an idea across quickly and hopefully with some emotional content.
Well, one point that your book drove home for me was that analogies aren't just in lofty speeches. They're all around us. You mentioned this, that save got you out of a hole. Like we encounter and use these analogies all the time without thinking about them. Why is it important to stop and think about them?
Well, a lot of analogies go past unnoticed. And in a sense, that's as it ought to be, because we stop to think about every single analogy that we encountered. We would stop every 3 seconds because they define our language. They define the way we get across ideas. However, we do need to be critical consumers of analogies because at certain points, if you embrace the wrong one, they can get you into big trouble. And so you have to keep an eye out, so to speak, keep an ear out for moments when analogies really play a defining role in which road you take in terms of action.
We hear a lot of analogies in the political arena, and you must have heard many, many of them, not only from Bill Clinton, maybe you wrote some for him, but also from world leaders. How do you use an analogy effectively and also, you know, make sure that it's one that holds water?
I would say that the analogies that one puts in a speech, you have more time, obviously, to hopefully examine them and look at why they might not be true. And this is something I urge people to do. When I say be a more critical consumer of analogy, that's especially important as we listen to all the political debates and the television ads. For example, in Iowa, the Republican candidate made a really engaging, funny television commercial based on analogy that said effectively, I grew up on a hog farm castrating pigs. Send me to Washington. I'll cut pork. And whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, it's really funny. And there are a lot of parallels between a pigsty and all the mud flying around in Washington. And that ad, in fact, helped boost her campaign a great deal. But here's the thing. The analogy is completely misleading because, as fun as it is, because the skills of castration are completely different than the skills of negotiation and compromise in the Senate, because I can guarantee you there's not a single senator who would agree to have one testicle cut off as a compromise.
Well, outside of pigs and politics, what are a couple of examples that you think of really effective analogies that you've run across in politics, in history, that were accurate, that really made the case and held water?
Okay, I'll give you a great one. Let's take the run-up to World War II, when the isolationists in Congress were saying, let's not get involved in that European war. It's not our business. And President Roosevelt said, we've got to get involved. We need to support the Allies and especially Great Britain. And he was pushing for what became Lend-Lease to supply war material to Great Britain to help fight the German onslaught. And he was at a press conference and off the cuff, he said, look, if your neighbor's house were on fire and you had a garden hose, you wouldn't go to him and say, hey, listen, I need $15 for my garden hose. You'd lend him the hose. They'd hook it to the hydrant, put out the fire, and then you deal with any damage or use to the hose afterward. And this became known as the garden hose analogy. And he said, we need to help Great Britain now. And that analogy really turned the tide of public opinion, and the Lend-Lease program came to pass some months later, and then, of course, a year or so later, we were involved in the war directly ourselves.
We're talking about analogies with John Pollock. He's the author of the book Shortcut, and you can join the conversation. Do you have a favorite analogy that you've used or read or heard? Is there something you've seen as especially effective or misleading in the worlds of politics, advertising, or maybe business?
Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about the power of analogies, and we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite analogy to share, and how do you think analogies spark innovation? Call us at 800-642-1234 or send us a tweet. Our handle is Central Time WPR.
John Pollock is with us. He's a former speechwriter for Bill Clinton, and his new book is Shortcut: How Analogies Reveal Connections, Spark Innovation, and Sell Our Greatest Ideas.
And in terms of the utility of analogies, how can they help us at work?
Well, people are bombarded with information all the time these days. And if you can make your point succinctly and in a memorable way, then you're going to become a better communicator. So whether you're trying to sell an idea or win an argument or sell a product, analogies can be a very, very helpful tool.
Can you give us an example of an analogy that maybe inspired innovation or helped crystallize thinking to spark innovation?
Sure. What was really exciting about researching and writing this book was that once you started to look at the great breakthroughs in history in terms of technology and ideas, they almost all had to flowed from an analogy that the inventor or the thinker realized. So let's take an example, the moving assembly line. Henry Ford gets the credit, but it really wasn't his idea. It was the idea of a man who worked for him, a young mechanic named Bill Clann. And Clann came back to Detroit from a trip to Chicago, and he said, effectively, guys, I know how we can build cars better. And at that time, Ford was just one of many startups building cars that took about 12 hours per car to build. And he explained how he had seen this disassembly line in the meatpacking plants where the hogs and the cattle were rolled along on these overhead trolleys hanging from hooks, and butchers, each doing a specialized task, took off their piece and sent it down to the next one. And he proposed doing this in reverse, assembling cars. And the people he worked with said, what are you talking about? That makes no sense. Those are pigs. We build cars. What do they have to do with each other? And he said, don't you see? It's exactly the same thing. Now, in retrospect, we see that they are. It's moving assembly, moving disassembly, specialized labor as the product moves past. However, if it were so obvious, then the Swift company, with all its millions in capital, would have done it, or the other auto companies would have done it. Ford himself was somewhat reluctant to try the idea, but they put in the line, and they... Or the first day there was an accident and they snapped a guy's femur. Mm. And the boss came down and a man named Cousins and said, stop this Rube Goldberg machine. We're not doing this. And Clann just begged him to continue. And they stopped the line. And for an hour, Clann tried to explain why this was going to change the world. And at the end of the hour, the boss looked at him and said, break all their legs. And they started up the line. And it changed history. And within a year, the time to manufacture a car was down to 90 minutes.
We'll go to a caller as we talk about analogies at 800-642-1234. We've got Carol on the line in Madison. Hi there, Carol.
Hello. I don't have an analogy to share, but I wonder if your guest would take a minute to explain the difference between an analogy and a metaphor. I hear a lot of analogies, and I know I hear metaphors. And to be perfectly honest, I'm not always sure which is which. Sometimes I am, and other times I'm not. So I want to just briefly explain that.
All right, Carol, thanks for the call. John?
Sure. Carol asked a good question. It's one that many people ask. And the truth of the matter is that similes and metaphors are just a type of analogy, just as a Granny Smith and a Fuji are types of apple. So for all practical purposes, thinking of them as analogies is perfectly fine because they are analogies. And so unless you're diagramming sentences in eighth grade, I wouldn't worry about it.
Now, I know you've thought a lot about what makes for an effective analogy. So what is the anatomy of an effective analogy?
Well, analogies do five things, basically. And the first thing they do is they use the familiar to explain something that's less familiar. The second thing is they highlight similarities and obscure differences. So, for example, the hog castration ad that we talked about, it highlights kind of the messiness of a barnyard and the messiness of Washington, but it obscures the fact that the skill sets are quite different. The third, an effective analogy will identify a useful abstraction. So, for example, in the moving assembly line and the hog disassembly line, the useful abstraction was specialized labor standing still as the product moved past. It's quite an abstract concept to think of it, but that lies at the heart of that analogy. The fourth thing that an effective analogy does is that it tells a coherent story. And it doesn't have to be a complicated story. It just has to be true as far as it goes, such as when I said dawn and sunset are the most interesting times of day. It's a simple, coherent story. It might not be a complete story, but it is coherent. And the last thing that an effective analogy does is that it should resonate emotionally. And that's really important because analogies, the good ones, generally tap into our emotions.
Do you have a favorite example of that, an emotion that really got hit for you by an analogy?
That's a really good question. I think that an example that comes to mind, and this is a broader analogy, but we were listening in the lead-in to the show to Martin Luther King Jr. delivering I Have a Dream. And he, like many preachers, was adept at analogy. And his success in marshaling public opinion in a divided country going through a difficult transition flowed largely from creating a big analogy between the struggle for freedom for African Americans in America and the struggle of the Israelites seeking freedom from the Pharaoh. And in casting the American struggle in biblical terms, he was able to bring in the moral values of the Bible, the emotional connection that millions of people felt with those values or associated with those values, and really was able to translate a legal challenge into a moral challenge. And that was very powerful. And every time I listen to that speech, it's very moving.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Kim on the line in Madison. Kim, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Kim?
Well, one of the things that I thought of a few years back. I was going through my divorce, and it's just an ugly mess if you know anybody who's been through a divorce. But there's this strange kind of curiosity that you get from friends and almost, you know, strangers sometimes, that they want, everybody wants to know how it's going and what's going on, and they're very curious. And I was thinking, you know, I just started telling people, it's kind of like roadkill. You don't really need to see all the stuff coming out, but you just can't stop looking. And I just, that's how I felt. Like, I just felt like this weird, macabre interest in my personal horror, you know?
Kim, thank you so much for sharing that. And John, whether it's a roadkill analogy or a train wreck or a car crash you can't look away from, we often look at our relationships in terms of horrific, heinous, bad things happening.
Yes, and sometimes we describe relationships as blossoming. Our love blossomed, and there you're bringing in associations with flowers and beauty, and then sometimes relationships wither or go bad. They're so useful, and that's why you see them infusing poetry so much.
Let's see if we can take one more brief call. Nick in Greenfield, briefly, what did you want to bring up, Nick?
Yeah, what I wanted to bring up is the point that an author, somebody who pins prose or article, that author cannot plagiarize their own work any more than a human being can be in two places at once. And the reason that I bring that up is because I keep hearing them accusing this writer for Mary Burke of plagiarism. And I'm saying that's not possible. You don't plagiarize your own work.
All right. Gotcha, Nick. And what about the analogy there, John?
Well, I don't have a specific comment on that because I don't know the specifics of the accusations. But I will say this, is that it's important to give credit where credit's due, and nothing is very original. And the more that in our time of recycling, that there's a lot of confusion around that, but the clearer that people can be, the better. But I'll tell you this. I quote my own work over and over, so I can't blame someone else for quoting their own work.
John, thank you. It's been eye-opening and food for thought. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
That was John Pollock. He's a former presidential speechwriter for Bill Clinton and the author of Shortcut: How Analogies Reveal Connections, Spark Innovation, and Sell Our Greatest Ideas.